Welcome to Macro Business Radio Podcast. Today I'm talking with David Llewellyn-Smith, Leif Van Onselen, and Lindsay David, author of Australia Boom to Bust. Today we're going to be talking about Australian real estate and the economy. Gentlemen, thanks very much for your time. Leif, I will start with you. There are reports in the media this week that the real estate market is gaining traction again in August and early September, but it was soft through June and July. Where are we at?
It's looking decidedly bubblicious at the moment. Prices are still rising. They're going to keep rising for a while yet. The best short-term indicator for the housing market is the total number of housing finance commitments ex refis, and those are still going along at a solid clip. At least if you use the ABS data, it looks like the market might have peaked in growth terms in the June quarter at around 11%, which means that the rate of growth is likely to start declining, but it's obviously off a pretty high base and it's likely to keep going for a while. And it's a pretty dangerous time, obviously, because housing valuations relative to GDP incomes, etc., are about to surpass their 2010 peak. And so Australia's looking at the most expensive housing market in its history, just as the biggest mining boom in the nation's history comes off in a big way, which is obviously, you know, a pretty dangerous situation, just as we've got rising unemployment.
Some of those charts you've been posting about Sydney investor behaviour in particular, that's looking pretty parabolic. Is that how you're seeing it?
Yeah, look, it's absolutely ridiculous, quite frankly. We've got more than one out of every two loans, so just over 50%, once you exclude refinancings, are going to property investors. It's something we've never seen before. We came close in 2003, 2004, but it's actually surpassed that. Melbourne's also looking pretty strong on the investor front. And then, of course, you can add in the foreign investors, which obviously the data's anecdotal. We don't have anything concrete, but every Tom, Dick and Harry who's in the market is reporting that there's very strong overseas interest. So that's also pumping demand.
David, you've long argued that the Reserve Bank of Australia needs to look at macroprudential policies to prevent a housing bubble. And I think you more than almost anyone would argue that we're not likely to see interest rates rise in the foreseeable future. How are you expecting this to play out from here?
I pretty much agree with everything Lee said in terms of where the market's at. In terms of macroprudential, well, you know, there have been hopeful signs over the last year and a lot of dumbfounding short-sightedness as well. The RBA has effectively endorsed macroprudential now at the top level, even though some of its lower-level economists continue to undermine that. However, APRA is clearly not moving towards any explicit macroprudential vis-a-vis New Zealand at the moment, and there are signs that APRA is doing things. A few months ago, they got together with the RBA and they released a new set of lending guidelines. This was effectively their macroprudential initiative. But, I mean, as you can see, it's a very bureaucratic and a weak-kneed approach. It's toothless to simply produce a piece of paper saying you've got to lend in this fashion. So, I mean, that was one effort, if you can call it that. But there are other signs that they're active, like the pending listing of QLMI, that is QBE's Lenders Mortgage Insurance business, is an interesting development and kind of suggests that the regulators may be pushing something behind the scenes. The Lenders Mortgage Insurance business is to insure the highest risk mortgages in the country, and it's been a duopoly, a highly profitable duopoly for a long time. Now, this will be the second half of the duopoly listing, and from a regulator's point of view, that makes a lot of sense insofar as it means it gets it away from the larger parent, that is QBE, and gets the LMI access to capital once it's floated. And so, in a sense, you can see that as preparation for losses, potentially, that won't turn into a greater systemic risk that might drag down a big insurer. That's all speculative, and it may not be the case, but I think that the regulators would certainly be very pleased that that's happening, and it may indicate that APRA is active behind the scenes. However, Moody's is out warning of something I've been pointing at now, well, for years, but more recently with greater intensity, and that is that the Australian banks are starting to borrow offshore much more in the last 12 months as lending rises and their deposits are falling. Post-GFC, APRA really pushed the banks to, you know, really do a kind of dollar-in, dollar-out deposit for lending kind of regime, which really helped them shift their liability profiles a lot towards deposits. The Moody's warning is really about the fact that that has now flipped over and the banks are being forced to go offshore to borrow more money. Now, that can only be happening if APRA has taken its foot off their throats. and said you can borrow more offshore and lend accordingly. They're no longer insisting on dollar in, dollar out, basically. So there's a whole lot of mixed messages about macroprudential, APRA and the RBA, but my take on it at this point is, for one reason or another, they're not going to get in the way enough.
So what are your thoughts about the risk of a housing blow-up from here?
Look, the banks themselves have said they're not able to reduce lending standards, and I think that's true. But as Leith has pointed out, this is an atypical kind of boom that we're going through here in that it's very investor-driven. We've never seen it before. And so the lending standards that are falling are for investors. It's more difficult to track. It shows up in things like, you know, no interest loans and loan to income valuations that, you know, have a lot of collateral and other things that confuse the picture. So there are probably constraints on what the boom was coming from or would have come from in the past, but I don't think that there's any constraint on where it's actually coming from now. So that's a long way of winded way of saying, yes, I think probably a blow-off is possible, but I wouldn't say it's a certainty.
Can I just add on the flip side, when it does come off, it's likely to come off harder because investor demand's obviously more flaky. And while it's going up strongly at the moment, it's forcing the market up. When that switch is hit and it goes into reverse, well, then you're likely to get, you know, a bigger downswing.
I might just add as well that what you were talking about before, where you've got the parabolic chart in investor loans, show that we've actually already had a blow-off. So it's kind of academic to discuss whether or not we're entering one. We're actually already in one. Even if prices aren't extended far beyond their highest levels ever, in terms of the structure of lending and where the buying is coming from, we're already in the throes of something pretty mad.
Especially given the precarious situation of the Australian economy. I mean, the last time we went through this kind of, well, an investor blow-off that wasn't quite as bad was in 2003, 2004, when Australia was about to embark in the biggest income and mining boom in its history. Well, now we're coming out the other end of that. So we've got a worse blow-off at a worse time.
That brings us to you, Lindsay David. You've written the latest contribution to discussion about Australia's real estate and its economy. Can I ask you, what inspired you to write a book about the economy and its real estate facet?
Well, basically, it's not just about Australian real estate. It's also about the Australian mining industry and the Australian financial services industry. And when you add that on top of the real estate industry, I like to call them the three pillars of the Australian economy. They're essentially the three sectors of the Australian economy that have brought Australia to the position that it's in today, which, in the view of many, seems to be quite a great success story. However, in saying that, I mean, I was a strategy consultant during the time of the financial crisis, building business plans, and generally when you were building a new strategy for a client, you generally had to have a bank in one form or another involved in the strategy and on board. And what I realised quite quickly is during the mid part of 2008 and onwards is, in this world, money can dry up. It can simply just disappear. And so I started to do a lot of research into how this American, Spanish, Irish situation unfolded and how these countries got to the point that they did and got to the insane levels of cost of real estate. And one thing was very clear is I understood that the banking system at a certain point in time becomes more generous than they would normally be in light of a property boom. That was one aspect of my motivation to write the book, because I just see so many similarities today in Australia than I did over in Europe and the US.
And when did you come back to Australia?
I moved back to Australia just last December, so I've only been here a couple of months.
Right.
After being overseas, I left around 2004. So it was pretty close to a 10-year stint. And what I understood was, in 2008, I was really fearful that Australians would take a big hit on this as well, being at the tail end of the global system. However, China came in and launched this billion-dollar stimulus, which has kind of been a several trillion-dollar stimulus today. And what I understood back in 2008 was that after the stimulus, Australia was pretty much all but guaranteed that till at least 2012, we would have China consuming every ounce of natural resource we could pump from the ground. And in turn, when you'd come back to Australia, well, it was such a bizarre feeling. It was like nothing had ever happened here. And you've just landed in from London or New York, and where people are pulling their hair out, and everyone here just seemed to be at the status quo, that things are fine, and everyone seemed to be having their best month when it came to business. So it was kind of confusing from the outside looking in and coming back all the time. And then in late 2012, I started the executive MBA program at IMD Business School. And because my company in Houston, Green Ricker, was too small to undertake the finance assignments, I had to choose a company. So I chose, because of the amount of time I'd spent traveling to and from China and just seeing visually seeing this construction boom, I chose Rio Tinto as the company I would do for my finance assignment. And it was two very big, complex assignments on the financial health of Rio Tinto. And what was very surprising to me was that the fundamentals of Rio Tinto as a business model, whatever it did internally, did not seem to either make a positive or as much of a negative impact as what the external factors of the mining industry were, e.g. China. So if China was to continue to grow and consume more Australian natural resources, well, the mining, not just Rio Tinto, but also its rivals could just continue to pump as much iron ore out of the ground. And no matter what they did for an immediate period of time, you would find that they would be profitable. But what I understood, diving deeper into the research, I was quite sceptical of all this construction in China. And believe me, I've seen a lot of these cities and towns throughout China that are empty. I mean, there's just not that many people living in them relative to the amount of construction there is. And they're building buildings at a faster rate than people are moving in. So you either walk out of China very amazed or very sceptical these days. So when I started diving deeper into my finance assignments for IMD, it just got crazier and crazier, all these numbers I was looking at, 4.7 billion square feet of real estate to be built in China in 1 year and under construction within a 12-month period. And then you would fly down to Sydney, and it really felt like Los Angeles or Miami back in 2005. So when I moved back here, I was like, well, I had these finance assignments in place, so there was a lot of data there, and I had a lot of data from my days as a strategy consultant. Now, you're looking at the cost of real estate here, and you think it's insane. Well, why don't you give the real estate industry the benefit of the doubt and the banking industry the benefit of the doubt and write a book, and if you can prove them wrong, well, you know, so be it. So when I started doing the research within the real estate and the banking sector, it was just mind-blowing. I mean, when you see the leverage of risk undertaken by a financial services system just squarely into real estate, you know, I tried to find other banks around the world that I could use as a benchmark to show how crazy investment into real estate was here. Not only that, just the financial health of the banking system. And I understood very quickly when I started looking at the balance sheets of our big four banks, just looking at them in face value, you wonder, well, geez, these balance sheets look awfully familiar to another bank I know. So I started rummaging back to 2007, and I found that there was an awful similarity in the business model. Even though I'm comparing an investment bank to retail banks, Lehman Brothers' balance sheet looked awfully similar to the balance sheet of the banks here in Australia. That's what kind of gives you the aha moment when you know, okay, well, the banks are pumping money into the economy. Well, if property prices are so high, well, the majority of the money that they must be pumping into the economy must be going into housing. And that was my thesis, and I think in the book I kind of proved that. And here in Australia, when you look at the relevant ratios that are commonly discussed, when you break down Sydney and it's looking at like around 10 times income here in Sydney, what's even more scary is when you start breaking it down suburb to suburb. I mean, Strathfield, I mean, for the median house price, and we're not talking apartments here, we're just talking a house price to income ratio is now over 20 times income, which is something where you would kind of let that go if we were talking about Mayfair or maybe certain pockets of Manhattan. But when you start breaking it down across the whole city of Sydney, for example, it's quite mind-blowing that there's all these areas have house price to income ratios all well incredibly in excess of 10 to 1. And then you start going out into the more rural parts of Australia, and I noticed that the cost of land in places like Mildura, where an apartment in Mildura is seemed to cost the same price as Chicago, and Alice Springs, like land per square metre in Alice Springs, is being sold for twice as much as it was in the back hills of Malibu, California. And, you know, you get told by everyone here that there's a housing shortage, that there's a land shortage. And when you land over Sydney or Melbourne or anywhere in Australia, you would not think that there is a land shortage. I mean, obviously, a lot of people argue that there's certain restrictions about it, but I was kind of still very sceptical about that. But it's when you start looking at Alice Springs and Mildura and the Bendigos and any city or town in Australia, I mean, they all seem to say they had the exact same problem, which was a housing shortage, which justified the high prices. And what I kind of uncovered was that there's simply no land shortage. But one thing there is here in Australia is an incredible sum of bank lending to home buyers. So if the banking system in a country becomes a lot more generous to home buyers, you're going to generate more demand or create more people with the financial ability to be able to purchase a home in the midst of a price bonanza where everything here just costs so much. It's something the world hasn't seen before, in my opinion, or at least in the Western world.
So, Leith, can I ask you, at the moment, is there a single realistic measure by which Australian real estate is not a bubble?
Not really. I mean, the best way to define a bubble is look at the value of housing relative to a bunch of fundamental indicators, so whether that be incomes, rents, GDP, whatever. And based on any of those, it, to me at least, it's a screaming bubble, and it has been for quite some time. Perhaps the one argument against it is to look at the ratio of mortgage interest payments or mortgage payments. And I guess given that nominal interest rates have fallen so strongly over the last 20 years, though, there is a case that obviously the cost of servicing a mortgage hasn't risen too significantly, even though the principal has risen dramatically. And there is also a case that obviously mortgage interest payments were a bit higher in the lead-up to the GFC, and they're also higher momentarily in the late 80s, early 90s, at least on an initial payment for a mortgage. The big difference today, though, however, is we are in a low inflation environment, and that means that a large mortgage taken out today is still going to be a large mortgage in 10 years' time, whereas in prior periods, particularly in the late 80s, mortgages were small and they were paid off very quickly due to high inflation. So it's not really an apples-with-apples comparison.
And David, do you see anything pointing to us not being in a bubble?
Well, the one that's always cited by, you know, Glenn Stevens and the RBA is the price to income measure, which rose, you know, very sharply through the millennium and then basically flatlined around 2003 and has been there for 10 years ever since. It's very expensive, but because it's created this plateau, authorities such as they are in a position to kind of say, well, if it's a bubble, it's been a bubble for a long time and therefore isn't a bubble. Like, to my mind, that's, you know, a bit ridiculous for the simple reason that underneath that plateau have been extraordinary political economy changes that have sustained the plateau. And so, you know, the initial burst of house price rises were driven by kind of advancements in derivatives and allowed the banks to get their hands on more money offshore. Then the second phase was supported through the mining boom and extraordinary historic income growth, which kind of backfilled what had happened in 2003. Then even so, once we hit 2008, you know, the offshore borrowing is still an essential prop to the real estate prices, and so when global markets shut down, those prices are no longer sustainable, and they were obviously starting to fall quite rapidly, and what transpired was wholesale and massive government guarantees to the entire thing. So to ignore the fact that you've totally transformed your political economy, completely rewritten the rules for your banking system, yoked the national budget to the sustaining of high house prices, whilst pointing to a plateau in high prices and saying that it's not a bubble, just doesn't pass the laugh test. To me, it's very clearly a bubble. In fact, it's one of the greatest bubbles in history, to the extent that it's totally distorted the economy and political economy of the nation.
Lindsay, you've come back to Australia within the last few months, so I'll ask you the same question about a bubble, but also can you reflect on how that shapes Australian society as being quite distinctive for someone who's coming back to it after a long time away?
Yeah, look, in Australia, one thing I can tell you after living overseas and you come back home is real estate's a sport. You just can't escape the real estate talk here, whether you're sitting around with friends or you're sitting next to someone on an aeroplane or you're at a wedding. Yeah, it just seems to be the most important topic. The obsession is very, very bizarre. People just can't get enough of talking about it. But in saying that, that does help, I think, in a way. We are kind of talking like property here as probably the Irish or the Spanish or the Americans were back in 2005, 2006, and people defend the current valuations of the property market with a lot of emotion. I mean, it's a very emotional topic, and since writing the book, I've come to realise more that it's actually an incredibly sensitive topic. Pitching the mere fact that there's a bubble in Australia is kind of like trying to sell meat to vegetarians. People just don't want to hear an ounce of it. But when you look at the current situation of the Australian real estate market, you look at the situation of our banks, and you use history as your guidance and see how other countries and banking systems and real estate markets have failed, well, all those ingredients have been thrown into the Australian real estate market. And today it's much easier to see where there's a bubble and where there isn't, especially with the fact that we have 2008 as such a good guidance on everything. But yeah, here in Australia, the metrics, there's no mathematics to justify the cost of property here unless the banks are lending at a toxic sum to home buyers.